the state of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning.
I got these mics.
Morning. We're delighted to welcome with us this morning Albany High School students. Would they stand up, please? Thank you. You may be seated. The Albany High School students are here with us with the Court with Class program. This is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Students are invited to come and join us for an oral argument, and if they accept, they are given the briefs in the case and may do additional assignments on the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then meet with a justice after the second oral argument this morning. Everyone is welcome to meet with the students and the justice after the second argument. The discussion will be about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of law in the case. Let me first say, if anyone would like a brief summary of the case, because you don't know enough about the case, the marshal will give you that summary prepared by our public information officer. Would you raise your hand if you want that kind of summary? Okay. So let me get to the next order of business, which is to introduce the court to you all. And I'll start on my far left, Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is an empty chair. Always check. Usually Justice John Wilcox sits there, but he will not be participating in this first case. And the right of the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. That's the lineup for this case. And I will call 2003 AP-2177 Deborah L. Kontowicz, is that?
Kontowicz.
Versus American Standard Insurance Company of Wisconsin, and Larry Bouillant versus Metropolitan Property and Casualty Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of the plaintiffs is attorney Edward E. Robinson. He will have 25 minutes, according to my notes. Mr. Ratzel, attorney Ratzel, will argue on behalf of American Standard for 15, and Mr. Piper will argue on behalf of Metropolitan Property for 15, and then you, Mr. Robinson, have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Satisfactory? All right. Mr. Robinson, you may proceed.
May it please the justices of the court, my name is Edward E. Robinson of the law firm of Cannon and Dunphy SC. It is my privilege to represent in this case the plaintiff's respondents petitioners in this consolidated appeal, which are Deborah Kontowicz, her husband Keith, their two children Scott and Katie, and then Larry Bayat. This appeal raises a novel question of law of significant importance to all Wisconsin residents who sustain property damage or bodily injuries as a result of the negligence of a third party and who must therefore turn to the responsible third party's insurance company for resolution and payment of their claim. The issue in this case is whether 62846, the timely payment of claims statute, applies to such third party claims so as to encourage such third-party insurance companies to promptly pay those claims and to not deny or delay payment absent a reasonable basis for so doing. Despite 62846, the statute's specific cross-reference to the Wisconsin Insurance Security Fund statute, 646312, which expressly includes third-party liability claims, the Court of Appeals in this case nevertheless ruled that the statute was ambiguous as to whether it applied to such claims, and ultimately the Court concluded that it did not. In so ruling, the Court of Appeals' decision fails to give effect to the clear, plain language of the statute. In so ruling, the Court of Appeals' decision runs directly counter to every one of its prior decisions, which have recognized that 62846 is an all-inclusive statute applying to all insurers and all insurance claims. In so ruling, the Court of Appeals' decision is at odds with the decision reached by every circuit court to have considered this issue of whether 62846 does in fact apply to third-party liability claims. Every single circuit court to counsel's knowledge to have considered this issue has determined that the statute in fact does apply based on its plain language. In so ruling, the Court of Appeals' decision also contravenes the Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner's longstanding interpretation of 62846 as broadly applying to all insurers and all claims. And finally, in so ruling, the Court of Appeals' construction of the statute contravenes the stated public policy of this state as embodied in prior appellate decisions and the insurance code of encouraging settlement over litigation and the fair and equitable treatment of all claimants. If allowed to stand, the Court of Appeals' decision will be the first decision to have exempted an insurance company from application of 62846.
Mr. Robinson, is there any question that liability must be established before the statute applies?
No. In fact, the Court of Appeals addressed that issue, Your Honor, in the Frischi versus Ford Motor Company case and basically came to the conclusion that the statute applies long before there's a judgment and a determination, a factual finding, if you will, as to the liability of the insured and therefore the liability of the insurance company. The Court said in that case, and the rationale was, the statute would be completely meaningless, the statute which the purpose of which is to encourage insurance companies to pay claims before a lawsuit is filed. That statute, Your Honor, would be rendered meaningless if it only came into existence after a full-fledged trial on the merits or perhaps an arbitration proceeding.
Counselor, so, isn't that case a first-party payment case?
That is correct.
Okay, so why is liability even a question with first-party pay? But in third-party pay, doesn't the insurance company have an obligation to defend against liability?
Well, actually, the case law, Your Honor, says that even though you're making a first-party claim, an uninsured or an underinsured motorist claim, your insurance company doesn't have to roll over and just pay your claim. I wish it were that easy for me. But, in fact, your insurance company has the right to stand in the shoes of the tortfeasor, and the case law says that. So they have the right to assert all of the same defenses as if the tortfeasor would have had insurance. So they stand in the shoes of the insurance that the tortfeasor should have had. So liability can still very much be an issue in a first-party case, and they're allowed to challenge and argue contributory negligence on the part of their insured. They're allowed to even argue that their insured was the majority at fault. So that first-party versus third-party distinction really doesn't hold water in terms of whether the statute should apply to third-party as well as first-party.
But, Counselor, how, aside from what you're telling me, how is an insurance company to pay a claim that it is never legally obligated to pay until the insured is found at least partially liable?
Well, again, the Court of Appeals in Frischi addressed that issue, and they said, look, the statute, here's the I think, one of the misconceptions about the statute. The statute does not say, thou shalt pay a claim, insurance company. What the statute says is the insurance company should timely pay a claim, but it doesn't have to. If the insurance company wants to litigate the claim, have its day in court, roll the dice, go through discovery, try to unearth some dirt on the plaintiff, maybe some evidence of pre-existing injuries and all this, then they don't have to respond to the demand for payment. They could choose to say, you know what, thanks but no thanks, we're not going to pay the claim. So it's rather a misnomer to say that the statute requires an insurance company to pay a claim. They can have their day in court if they want. But what the statute does say is this. If you, as an insurance company, decide not to pay the claim based on the proof that's before you, and you roll the dice and you go through litigation, and later on, at the end of the day, through your discovery and all of the information you've obtained, you have failed to come up with a basis to support your denial and your failure to timely pay that claim all that time ago, then not only do you have to pay that claim, but now you have to pay the plaintiff for the lost value of that, lost time value of that money. Because at the end of the day, you came up to the conclusion that this was a claim that should have been paid, and it wasn't timely paid.
Counselor, are you talking about the reasonable proof that an insurance company can have to fail to pay the claim when it's first made, a demand is first made?
That is, in fact, the standard in the statute. And it's
is that a question of fact or question of law?
Well, it is a question of fact. In fact, the trial court would have to determine, and the trial court determined in each of the cases that have now been consolidated, the trial court made those factual findings.
And is it a question of fact or a question of law? You're saying it's a question of fact. Is it determined at the time the demand for payment is made, or is it determined someplace down the road?
Well, I think the time period goes back to the date that the demand is paid, and it's an objective standard, not a subjective standard. I would submit that the reasonable proof standard is this. Would a reasonable insurance company in the position of this particular insurance carrier, when presented with this information and proof, would they have paid the claim, thought to themselves, this is a claim that should be paid or not? I think that's the standard. It's an objective standard.
Can I ask a follow-up question to Justice Rogan Sachs? I'm having a problem with understanding all of the facts in this case, and I want some help with this.
Sure.
With respect to the Kontowitz claim, when was that claim first made based on your position?
Well, I don't know if there's a finite point in time that you could point to and say, this specific date, Your Honor, was the date the claim was made. I think, as is true with most claims, they mature over time and they develop over time. In fact, I think that the very text, Your Honor, of 62846 recognizes that fact if I'm able to open it up. If we look at the actual text, Your Honor, of 62846, I'm looking midway through subsection 1, the first subsection of the statute, Your Honor, and it talks about any part or all of the remainder of the claim that is subsequently supported by written notice is overdue if not paid within 30 days after written notice is furnished to the insurer. And I suggest what the legislature is recognizing there is that there may be a claim where you present information and the insurance company says, you know what, you're asking for X number of dollars now, but we don't believe that entire amount is supported by what you've sent to us. But there is a partial amount that is supported. Medical bills, for instance, in a typical bodily injury claim, wage loss that's documented by the employer. So those components may be supported by the proof of loss.
Let me see. Let me see if I can pin down my question a little bit more clearly. I'm looking a little earlier in this section. A claim shall be overdue if not paid within 30 days after the insurer is furnished with A, written notice of the fact of a covered loss, and B, of the amount of the loss. And I guess what's concerning me, at least with respect to one of the two actions, is when that took place and whether there is a substantive or factual distinction between notice that there will be a claim and notice that there is a claim.
Well, first of all, what Judge Hassan, the circuit court judge that had the case, what he ruled and what the determination that he made, which I think is eminently correct, he ruled that a claim was presented to American Standard I believe the date was, maybe it's not material, but it was January. Bear with me a second. I'll give you the exact
date. January 8th, 01?
Yes.
The letter?
8th, 01. That's three, added 3 days for mailing. Our office had mailed over to Counsel for American Standard after they entered an appearance, and we knew who was representing them in the lawsuit. We had mailed over to them a copy of the discharge summary from Frater Memorial Lutheran Hospital, which confirmed that, unfortunately, Deborah Kontowitz was a quadriplegic.
And that would give written notice of the covered, the fact of a covered loss.
Exactly. That, go ahead, Your Honor.
My question is, as I understood the letter, and I don't want to read words into your argument, but as I understood the letter, that there was also an accounting of that which had been paid to date.
Well, the other part of the letter, Your Honor, was enclosing the summary of the medical bills to date for her initial hospitalization. And I want to make this point. With the billing statements attached thereto, this wasn't just our office saying, here are the bills, here's what the bills are, trust us. The actual bills were attached to that summary itemization of the bills. So on that date, they knew that she was a quadriplegic, and they knew that her medical bills alone, up to that point in time, were in excess of $200,000.
And I guess the gist of my question and where I'm going with this is, unless I'm misreading the letter, and point me if I'm wrong, I didn't see anywhere in the letter where there was a request that the insurance company make payment for the amount of damages paid up to that point in time. And that's where I'm getting at. Is there a distinction between showing that, yeah, we have a covered loss, and we are giving you an accounting up to this point, but not requesting payment for it versus, yeah, this is what we pay this, and we're going to have more down the road. Do you understand my question?
I do understand the question. Let me respond this way. You are correct, Your Honor. Our letter of transmittal that sent the discharge summary along with the itemization did not say, please pay the amount of the medical bills, thank you. But what Judge Hassan had indicated, and this was the determination he made, is that letter was sent out after a lawsuit was filed against American Standard and its insurers. And in the prayer for relief, in the complaint, we specifically indicated our intention to recover all interest that may be due and owing pursuant to Section 62846. So American Standard can hardly express, I guess, concern or confusion as to why they were being sent this information when the complaint made it clear that we were intending to hold them liable for all interest under the timely payment of claim statute.
Thank you.
I don't know if I answered your question.
Okay. Thank you.
What's the intersection between this procedure and a demand to admit? I mean, you said you forwarded in that letter the, I think, $238,000 of medical. Why don't you just slap a demand to admit on that document, and then you get 12% of interest from the, you know, assuming it's really not going to be controversial in the kind of case that you're talking about with regard to Deborah Kontowitz. To me, would be the traditional approach.
Well, let me just make sure I'm clear. Is Your Honor referring to the procedure under the request to admit statute that provides a remedy for a party where they send out admissions that are denied? At the end of a trial, they can bring a motion in front of the judge to ask the court to award the costs incurred in proving up that claim at trial.
Yes.
I'm not, okay. Because Your Honor said 12% interest, and I'm not aware, but perhaps I'm mistaken, I'm not aware that under the request to admit statute you get 12% interest if you are successful with your motion pursuant to that statute.
What is it, 5%? What's the percent? Anyway.
Well, under 80701, the offer of settlement statute, there is an interest rate, but let me respond this way.
I'm sorry. No wonder your question for clarification. I meant the offer to settlement.
Okay.
That's exactly
the And I'm sorry for my confusion. Here's the problem with 80701. It's a great statute, and I'm glad it's on the books. It's there for our benefit. It's there for the defendant's benefit because they have the right to file an offer of judgment under the statute. The problem with that statute, however, is the only way that you ever recover pre-judgment interest, I guess it would be pre-verdict interest, under that statute is if you actually go through with the trial. And you recover a more favorable amount, I guess, with respect to costs if you recover the same amount. I know one of them, you have to recover more to get it. The other one, you just have to recover the same amount or more. But the point is this. You actually have to go through with the trial at great expense and recover a more favorable amount to get the benefit of the statute. So the problem, of course, is that if an insurance company at the 11th hour on the proverbial doorsteps of the courthouse says, you know what, we want to pay the claim, we want to settle the claim, and they finally offer all of that time later what should have been offered a long time ago, and you ultimately settle the case because your client advises you, I don't want to roll the dice, it's a good number, it's a fair number, I want to settle, then you're never going to get any interest because you only get interest if you actually go through with the trial and recover a more favorable amount. And the insurance company has no adverse repercussions whatsoever for having required you to go to the court steps on the day of trial to get to pay the money to you. So it's ineffectual in that regard. And 62846 applies from the day you make a demand for payment, 30 days, they have an interest-free period of time. You know, the thing about the statute is, despite all of the insurer's arguments to the contrary, this is not some shocking principle that a person should pay a bill timely. I mean, we all have bills that come in, and we see this all the time. Maybe you get a bill from your tax accountant. Maybe you get a bill from an attorney that you're paying hourly. Maybe you're getting a bill from your dentist, and it says payment due within 30 days. If payment's not received within 30 days, we're going to add an interest fee. And it, maybe it's 1%. Sometimes it's 1.5% with some of these revolving credit cards out there. If you don't pay the full balance within 30 days, it's like 21% interest. This is how we do business here. Once you get a bill, you have 30 days to pay. If you decide not to pay, that's your choice. And if ultimately the person has to sue you to get you to pay the bill, just know that when you finally do pay the bill, you're going to have to make up to the person for the lost time value of that money. And that's what the statute does.
What if there's a dispute about the amount? I mean, I agree that I got services, but the services were not well rendered, and so I shouldn't pay for it all. Or I got a defective table and I had to repair it, so I shouldn't pay you for the entire amount. And then I win at trial. Do I get do I have to pay 21% on anything?
Look, absolutely not, Your Honor. No one has ever claimed in this case that every insurance company is going to have to pay interest if they deny the claim. That is absolute insanity. Of course not. An insurance company has the right to debate claims that are debatable. If the statute says if you have reasonable proof to deny your responsibility, you aren't liable for interest. So, of course, for instance, if there's a case where there's an intersectional collision between the plaintiff and the defendant, no eyewitnesses and both parties are claiming that they had the green light, and we represent the plaintiff. Well, we wouldn't represent the plaintiff perhaps in that case. But if someone were representing the plaintiff in that case and they presented a demand to the insurance company, your driver ran the red light, because that's what my client says, pay me this money, of course the insurance company is not going to have to pay interest if they decide not to pay the money and the case goes to trial, even if the plaintiff prevails at trial. Even if the jury decides that the plaintiff met her burden of proof or his burden of proof, even then the insurance company doesn't have to pay interest because certainly there was a reasonable basis under those facts to deny the claim.
So your position is there's no reasonable basis in both these cases to deny liability. So the is that your position?
Well, we have to be careful. There's not a lot of case law that's interpreted the term reasonable proof to deny responsibility. I submit on behalf of the plaintiffs, appellants, petitioners in this case, that the standard is actually an objective standard. Would a reasonable insurer in the position of this insurance company have paid the claim?
And your answer is no.
And with respect to both of these cases, a reasonable insurer would have paid the claim, correct? And that's what the court held.
All right. So then you have the question of how much, right?
That's correct.
All right. In your position on the paraplegic damages, it was clearly a full policy.
Well, that's not exactly correct.
Okay.
Your Honor probably picked up on the fact that we did not appeal from Judge Hassan's decision to limit the accrual of interest on January 8, 2001 to simply the amount of the medical bills. And I think as of that point, getting back to the question of Justice Butler, you know, given that the letter of January 8th didn't say, by the way, pay me this money, that's why I'm sending you the bills, I think it was reasonable for Judge Hassan to limit the interest running as of that date to the amount of the medical bills. And it wasn't until later on, Your Honor, that we actually said, pay us the full 500,000 limits. And so,
530, is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. So what Hassan came
up... I'm sorry, finish your answer because I have another question.
I'm saying, so what Judge Hassan, how he resolved the issue is he said, as of January 8th, 2001, interest started running on the amount of the medical bills that were supported by the...
$100,000?
Correct.
Okay.
And then as of July, when we said, pay us the 500,000, you clearly owe us words to that effect. As of that date, when they didn't pay, that's when interest started to run on the full 500,000. And so it comes to a little bit less than $50,000 in the record.
Wasn't there a factual error in the judge's decision, though? Because as I understand the statute, even under your position, the interest doesn't accrue until after 30 days has run where payment has not been made. And as I understood the judge's ruling, if your demand was on July 30th, it wouldn't be until after August 30th or whatever the following Monday is that the actual interest should start to kick in. Yet he made his ruling as of August 2nd. So he only gave really the insurance company 3 or 4 days and already started running the interest. Doesn't it start running from after the 30 days hasn't been paid, or am I misunderstanding it?
Well, no court has addressed that issue. Your honors are going to have to address that issue, perhaps in this case. But the issue is, and that's an issue that we can contend here, there's a difference of opinion on how it should work. Our position is that the statute works like it does, you know, at holiday time. These furniture stores, appliance stores say, come in, buy a lot of stuff, and there's no interest, no payments for a whole year. But what happens if you decide, if you're late with that payment and you don't make that payment before that year is up, all of the interest going back to the date you bought the stuff at the store is now charged to your account. So in that sense, and we've argued that the statute works the same way, it's like a 30-day interest-free evaluation period. You have up to 30 days to evaluate the claim, and as long as you've paid it within that 30 days, no interest runs. But to the interpretation that, well, if they don't pay within 30 days, interest doesn't start running until the 31st day, I would suggest to you that would undercut the whole point of the statute, because basically you're encouraging the insurance company to not pay the claim within 30 days if they know that the worst that's going to happen if they pay on the 32nd, 35th, 40th day is we're only going to have 2 days, 8 days, or 10 days of interest rather than going back to the date they actually got the submission. But there's no case, to my knowledge, Your Honor, that has considered and addressed the issue of when interest starts to run if the 30 days pass and no payment is made.
Counselor, I want to take you back to Fishy again in my initial questions where I have some concerns about liability. Wasn't liability of the individual defendant conceded in Fishy?
You may be correct, Your Honor.
And wasn't the question that was presented whether you had to have a judgment in order to fall under the statute or whether a claim that was ripe and discernible was also sufficient?
I think that's partly true, Your Honor, but the other issue in that case was the issue of personal injury damages by their nature being nebulous, claims for pain and suffering.
I'm more concerned about the liability question, though. Do you know of any case where any appellate court has said that there is no need to determine liability on the part of the insured before a claim is ripe for presentation under this statute by a third party?
Well, no, I think the case law is scant on personal injury cases, so the answer would be no.
Okay, thank you.
There's no case either way, Your Honor. The point, though, is that the test, again, is reasonableness, and the point is that in a rear-end accident, if you're stopped at a red light and someone rear-ends you, and your car is crumpled up, and you go, even if you go to the insurance company's own drive-up service center where they say, bring in your car, we'll appraise it, and they give you an appraisal, this is how much it's going to cost to fix your car. If the insurance company, I see my time is up.
You may just finish your sentence. And Justice Prosser, I think, has a question. Do you have a question?
There seems to be a little difference. Well, let me ask this.
Could the filing of a complaint serve as the notice of claim?
Absolutely. I would think that when the insurance company gets a complaint alleging that their insured was negligent, injured the plaintiff, and is now being sued for money damages, absolutely, that's notice.
How long does the insurance company, or how long does the defendant have to answer the complaint?
Under the statute, it would be 45 days to file an answer.
So your position is really interest would start to run before the complaint even needs to be answered. Is that right?
In that factual scenario, if we assume that there's been no prior information that the insurance company has collected or that's been sent to the insurance company, so their first notice of a claim is the receipt of lawsuit papers, then there would be a potential issue, I suppose, about the 30 days under 62846 and the 45 days answer time. But, of course, in this case, there is no issue in either of the cases about the time being the date they got the complaint. That's not an issue in this case. Perhaps it could be in a different case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ratzel, representing American Standard.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Jim Ratzel and I represent American Standard. The most fascinating part of Attorney Robinson's argument was when he gave the examples of payments, payment to your dentist, payment to your lawyer, payment to a store. Those are all first-party claims. Every single example he gave to rely on his argument, he had to fall back on a first-party claim in order to make it seem appropriate for 628. 628 is a law that is meant for first-party claims, and it works well for first-party claims.
Well, but it says third-party. 646.31, isn't it 2D? The cross-reference?
What 628 does is, in the context of 628, it refers to 646 for a type or class of claim. But what happens is when you apply that class to 628, it's still a first-party claim coverage. A third party under certain circumstances may have a first-party claim, for instance, a MedPay provision or a UM claim, but it still is a first-party claim. You can look at the wording of the statute. That's very key. You see that it uses terms that are first-party terms. When it talks in terms of a proof of loss, when it says unless otherwise provided, the whole concept of a written notice, you need to look at the relationship between a first party and the insurance company.
Mr. Ratzel, before you get there, maybe I want to follow up on the Chief's question because I am looking at the wording of the statute. And the wording of the statute in 628.46 sub 3 says this section applies only to the classes of claims enumerated in section 646.31 sub 2. You get to sub 2, classes of claims to be paid. No claim may be paid under this chapter unless the claim is made in one of the following, classes. In sub D, third-party claimants, a claim under a liability or a workers' compensation insurance policy if either the insured or the third-party claimant was a resident of this state at the time of the insured event. What is unclear about that?
I think the statute, in both statutes, candidly, it may be ambiguous because of the terms first party, third party. When 628 uses that reference, they're talking in terms of a third party that's essentially making a first party claim. Because in the context of 628, it's a first party statute. And all they're recognizing is that there may be third parties that essentially have the ability through a contract to make a first party claim. So that's where you use the language. And admittedly, it is awkward language. But when you look in the totality of the circumstances, 628 is a first-party claim statute. In first-party coverage, there's a unique contractual relationship. Because of that, if, for instance, I go out and my window is busted on my car because a tree fell on it, I have a contract with my insurance company There's a relationship there. So I present that claim to the insurance company. There's no question of liability because I have the appropriate coverage. Also, there's no question as to what it's going to cost to repair that window. It's going to cost $700. So when I say to my insurance company, I have a busted window, they look at it and say it's going to cost $700.
Counsel, just a minute. Under B, it says paragraph A doesn't apply to property and casualty insurance. So why aren't your examples property insurance, or have I missed something?
I'm not sure. Which section are you referring to?
628.46.1b. Doesn't that say that? Do I have it copied it wrong?
628.46.1b.
No such statute. Maybe it's 2MB2. Maybe.
Great.
So my real question is, does 628.46.1 cover property and casualty?
Yes, first-party claims, yes. Because there's an absolute dollar amount. It's not in dispute. Also, liability is not in dispute. So if I present this claim to the insurance company and the insurance company just says, no, we're just not going to pay it, that's when the insurance company should get penalized because there's no dispute as to liability and the dollar amount is certain. The same can't be said for a third-party claim. As a matter of fact, with a third-party claim, the insurance company doesn't even know the claimant's out there. There is no relationship of contract. There is no fiduciary duty. And more importantly, there's no duty to cooperate if you're a third-party claimant. In fact, in response to Justice Butler's question as to what the claim in this case, you look at the record, the claim consisted of essentially a retainer letter coming in saying, we represent this third-party claimant, all the authorizations are revoked, and we're going to give you more information in the future. That never arrived. Yet the 30-day clock, according to the plaintiff, was arguably running. Then the lawsuit's filed, and then the discovery process begins. And it wasn't until several months later that finally there was a demand for the policy limits.
Your position is even if we were to accept the plaintiff's position here, the clock doesn't start until sometime after the July 30th, 2001 demand. Is that correct?
Well, my position is the clock doesn't start at all because that's a third-party claim. So in a third-party
claim. I'm saying if we were to accept their position. I'm just trying to pin down when the clock starts to run.
Well, the clock would have to run when the plaintiff complies with the statute, and that requires a written notice, which is arguably when they demanded the policy limits and presented sufficient information. The problem with the Kontowitz case is discovery was still continuing. There was not a liability determination. So both sides still were conducting discovery, trying to figure out the value of the case and the exposure. That's not the case with a first-party claim with my busted window example, where the insurance company knows they have to pay, they know the dollar amount, and yet they simply don't pay. That's why they put in this provision in terms of a penalty for the interest for the insurance company.
Counsel, does the statutory term reasonable proof require a determination of liability?
I think that has to be encompassed in that because in the first-party context, there is no liability question. So that term, reasonable proof, it's hard to apply that in the third-party context because you have reasonable proof of what? Did we know that Mrs. Kontowitz sustained an injury? Yes, we knew that. Now, as we sit here today, do we know the liability picture? No, we don't. So you can't apply that reasonable proof term in 628, which is a first-party statute. That's not easily applied to a third-party claim because that's why we have jury trials. The jury ultimately determines what's reasonable and what the parties did and who met their burden of proof.
Can't you settle?
Pardon me?
Can you not settle?
Can we settle? Sure.
So you make a determination of reasonable amount of damages and liability, right?
Sure. Absolutely.
And if you have a case in which liability is clear and damages are substantial, Are you saying that under a third-party claim, interest is never recoverable?
I don't think it's recoverable under 620.28. I don't think it's recoverable because conceptually it's, you run into problems because the parties, it takes months, as all of the justices are aware from their past experiences in trials, it takes a long time to develop the facts, to make determinations as to liability. You can't do that in 30 days.
Counsel, I thought your argument is, just like you respond, that reasonable proof doesn't apply to the third party claim in this case. But if you take it out of a third party claim, are you asserting that, when are you asserting that there would have been reasonable proof from your perspective? When did you set the reserves at $500,000 in your case?
That raises a different question in terms of the concept of a reserve really is remote from ultimately what the liability is. But my understanding, and I don't do setting of reserves for insurance companies, my understanding it's primarily for an accounting purposes. You look at what's the worst possible exposure. It doesn't mean you're liable for that. You're just making an initial judgment determination. There have been numerous trials I've had where the reserves have been set fairly high and we go to trial and we win. The jury says there's no liability. So the reserve is more of an accounting aspect for the insurance company. It should not have any play in terms of the actual liability of a party.
As I looked at the facts of the case, now, it's the two cases we have before us, of course, raise an interesting juxtaposition. But with regard to the Kantanowitz case, it seems to me it's not difficult to assess the value at being in excess of $500,000.
And I guess my response, Madam Justice, is the plaintiff is trying to do with 628 what they can't do with summary judgment. If they had filed a summary judgment motion and said, Judge Hassan, we want you to say as a matter of law our damages are X amount and the liability is this, Judge Hassan would have had to say, I can't do it, it's a question for the jury. Similarly, what even though as lay people we may say, wow, that's a serious case, I don't think we ever want the courts in this state to be in a position to start saying, as a matter of law, certain injuries are worth a certain amount of dollars.
Well, and that's why you can take this one case. I mean, it is, I will be frank, it is difficult for me to perceive an 88 in a 35 zone rear-end collision. Things always happen, but that's pretty much a 100% liability case. I mean, you don't get them much better than that. And unfortunately here, the damages and the injuries are really severe in terms of the quadriplegia.
I agree with the severity of the injury, but
this case seems to be the factually pure case to test the limits of what you're saying.
Except we still don't know what a jury would do with this case in terms of liability. We have yet to depose Mrs. Kantowitz. We don't know, admittedly, from the facts of the case, there's a massive amount of skid marks being left by as this car is approaching her vehicle. We don't know what she saw, what she perceived at the time she pulled out. There are some circumstances under which a jury may place negligence on Mrs. Kantowitz that could potentially exceed. Because there's the potential.
And what kind of circumstance is that? Is that perhaps she was stopped in the middle of the highway? I mean, that kind of thing?
My point is, it's a question for the jury. I don't think we ever in this state want to have the court saying that we're going to say as a matter of law there's liability here, here, and here, and the damages are a minimal amount. I don't know what the facts are. I agree with you, and don't get me wrong. I agree with you, it's certainly an uphill, it's a tragic accident. But I don't think, if he couldn't do this in summary judgment, have a determination that there's no negligence, we can't do it with 628.
It's your position, regardless of the third party claim argument that you advance in terms of the interpretation of the statute, that you can never have reasonable proof until you take it to a jury.
No. You could, that might be true in the third-party context. In the first-party context, you can have reasonable proof. When I submit my bill for a broken window to the insurance company, there's no question of liability. There's no question of damages. They have to fix my broken window.
What about in the UIM or UM context? You know, here I am, you're my insurer, first-party claim, and I have the same kind of fact situation as the plaintiff in the Kantanowitz case. Are you going to say to me, you know, there could be that thread of possibility that just stopped in the middle of the highway?
I think until we explore all the facts which our justice system allows, the adversarial system, I think we have to, both sides have to explore all the facts and be given that opportunity. I will say this, in that context where you do have an injury claim, suddenly there is a greater duty to cooperate. You start getting into different elements, but ultimately that's still a question for the jury in terms of what is this case worth, who is really at fault in this case, because otherwise we have to separate it from what you and I may be saying on the street over a cup of coffee in terms of, wow, that's a bad accident. It's quite another thing to be going into a court and say, you have to say as a matter of law, a broken leg is worth $25,000 and that somebody that runs a stop sign is automatically 100% at fault, and I don't think we ever want to do that.
I understand that part of the argument. You know, you don't want, you know, what's a broken arm worth in a intersection collision when yellow light is involved? You know, who knows that? But it seems to me, and that's one of the difficulties coming up with the procedure here. You know, when is there reasonable proof? How is there reasonable proof? But you seem to undermine your argument in some ways by not conceding the Kantanowitz case. Can you respond to that?
The problem I have is maybe a conceptual problem. I have a problem plugging in the terms and the requirements of 628 into the Kantanowitz case, because the Kantanowitz case is a third-party case. And these facts would be completely simple in applying it to 628 if it was a first-party claim.
But only certain first-party claims, like property damage, where the insured gets paid, but not UM or UIM, where it's a liability for an auto. You're not willing to fit it into 628.
I think what I used my property damage, because that's the easiest example of how 628 works, and that's why I used the example. I think that 628 encompasses all first-party claims. Some may be easier than others.
What about medical insurance, health care?
If it's a first party coverage and you have the contract with your health insurance carrier, I think they should be under the same auspices as the liability carrier. So I would agree with you, Madam Justice, that if I submit a bill to a doctor and it's my health carrier and I paid a premium, they should pay or reimburse me for that or get charged interest. And my time's out.
Justice Prosser has a question.
I'm trying to figure out exactly what a third party is in your view under the 646.31.2d. In a workers' comp situation, as I understand it, an employer buys a policy with a company to protect workers, and the worker, in effect, is the third party making the claim. Now, who is the third party who is covered under this statute, under an automobile insurance policy?
I would say an example off the top of my head would be a passenger riding in a car where the driver has a policy of insurance. Under certain terms of insurance contracts, that passenger may make a claim, may make a first-party claim, even though arguably that's a third person. So there are scenarios, but this is really focused on the first party. But what the statute does is recognize there are, through contractual relationships, certain situations in which third parties may actually be making first-party claims. But it does not expand it to any and all third-party claimants out there, because that's just not within the reading and the context of the statute.
Counselor, what's so different about somebody that's a passenger and your insured drives negligently, so the passenger gets hurt in an accident, from the third party who's in the other car and gets hurt because your insured drives negligently? I don't see the real
difference.
Because
the passenger has the benefit of the insurance contract. That third party, there's absolutely no relationship between that third party and the insured.
So you're saying that the passenger would have to be an insured under the contract?
Depending on the wording of the policy, such as with medical payments. Oftentimes on a property claim or on a, you know, with a house.
Well, I want to talk about the automobile accident because that's the hard question for me.
Correct. There may be coverage extended to a passenger under certain policies of insurance. And all that passenger is fortunate to be is to be in a vehicle that there's a contract on that vehicle, insurance contract, that provides coverage to that individual. That third party out there that blows the stop sign or whoever that third party is doesn't have that same benefit, and as a result is a complete stranger to the insurance contract.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
I know your time is up, but there's one thing that is bothering me about both your argument and your opposing counsel's argument with respect to the effects of the 1999 amendment and how it impacts on this first-party, third-party type analysis that you're making. And correct me if I'm reading something wrong here, but when I look at the prior version, 640.631 sub 2D, and how that statute was amended, what it appears from my reading is that under sub 2 and under sub 3, what has happened is that out-of-state individuals who were involved in any injuries or property damage in the state are no longer covered by the statute. So I don't agree or understand the argument that this is just a redundancy. I do see a substantive change, but I don't see how it really goes to the first-party argument either, because where it appears, in terms of at least the plain meaning of the statute, is that the legislature made a decision to take out-of-state individuals who are involved in either injuries or property damage. Am I misreading that?
I will concede that's an interpretation, but I think my reading of it, and I think a proper reading of it also is it's an attempt by the legislature to somewhat narrow the focus. And I know you're saying in terms of out-of-state versus in-state, I think it can also be read to exclude or narrow the focus even more to eliminate any questions.
Is there any other piece of legislation, anything else in the insurance statutes that use the term third-party claimant and really intend it to mean a third-party claimant who is in the shoes of a first-party claimant?
I'm not sure. I will. The one thing feature I do think is interesting with 628 is when you talk about a third-party claim in the Workers' Comp Act. While 628 does reference Workers' Comp, the very first sentence of 628 says, unless otherwise provided by law, as this Court is aware, Chapter 102 of the Workers' Comp Act sets forth a specific penalties for delay and bad faith. So there's deference again by the writings of 628 to defer to statute and law that's already in existence. Similarly, in third-party context, we have the rules of civil procedure, whereby the legislature is giving deference to, for third-party claims, to the rules of civil procedure.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Metropolitan Property, represented by Mr. Piper. Attorney Piper.
Good morning. Don Piper of Piper and Schmidt for Metropolitan Property and Casualty Insurance Company and its insured, Jason E. Schoeschel. What I'm going to try to do this morning in my brief 15 minutes of time is explain three things that I think will answer the questions I've heard so far. In this oral argument, I'll discuss why the interaction between 628.46 and 646.31 sub 2 is controlled by 628.46's sub 3's use of the word only, and how this interaction solves the perceived problems raised by the petitioners. I will also discuss how our first-party position is consistent with an under versus against distinction, and how our first-party position is consistent with the wording of 628-46, the difference between first- and third-party claims, and the resolution of third-party claims in particular in our adversarial system. Let's begin by realizing that both 628-46 and 646-31 are standalone statutes. The petitioners have said as much in their brief. I believe the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers said it, and it is the case. I'm a low-tech lawyer. Here's my circle of 646-31 sub 2. This statute identifies people with Wisconsin connections who are eligible to make security fund claims. That's what it does. If you look at the statute, it lists residents, non-residents, it lists people. 628-46 discusses insurance claims against insurance companies. The question to be addressed is how do these statutes interact? How do these standalone statutes interact? 628-46 sub 3 is the linking statute. It states that this section applies only to the classes of claims enumerated in 646-31 sub 2. It uses the restrictive word only, not the expansive word all that petitioners want the court to assume was used. It references, but does not incorporate in total, 631 sub 2. Think of it this way. 646-31 sub 2 is the full set. 628-46 is the subset. Having in mind the standalone nature of the statute and the only distinction I just made, how does it all come together? Here's how it comes together. Some, but not all, people in 646-31 sub 2 can make 628-46 interest claims.
Say that one more time, please.
Sure. Some, but not all, people in 646-31 sub 2 can make 628-46 interest claims.
Mr. Piper, I have to confess, I'm somewhat confused by the set and subset argument. If they're standalone, how can one be a subset of the other?
They start off as standalone statutes with different purposes, security fund purpose, interest purpose. In that sense, they're standalone. I believe that claims against the security fund are resolved in Chapter 646. It controls, and this statute, 628-46, controls interest claims. And I, Justice Butler, I had trouble with new math when I was in high school way back when, but I think I have it right this time, because here's what we have. We need an overlap between both sets. We start off with the legislature saying, you know what, rather than just identify all the people who can make 628-46 interest claims, we'll do a shortcut. We'll find in the statutes some other provision that identifies people with Wisconsin interest, connections rather, that the legislature wanted to protect. And they found this statute. And it is a listing of people with Wisconsin connections that the legislature wanted to protect. So they start off by saying these are the people who can potentially make a 628-46 claim. Now we have to put the subset on the main set. And where it intersects, that's where we have the connection between these statutes. And the key is that you have to have a 628-46 claim to begin with. Mr. Byatt, Mr. Kontowitz are over here. You ask for examples about who could make this kind of claim, what kind of third party could. Mr. Ratzel mentioned the passenger in the auto who is a stranger to the driver's contract, total stranger. That passenger is entitled to make an uninsured motorist claim, a MedPay claim, under the driver's policy. the intersection occurs, that kind of third-party claimant can actually get interest. Another example is in the homeowner's context. If your neighbor comes to your home and slips on your front porch, that neighbor can make a MedPay claim under your homeowner's policy. The neighbor is a stranger to the contract, but the contract allows this to occur. And why does it allow it to occur? It goes back to that concept of moral risk. First-party insurers don't have to accept the application of an insured. But when they do their underwriting and decide, yes, I'm going to insure you, they've accepted the moral risk of the insured. And then with that comes fiduciary duty, trust, a whole set of different rules on how first-party claims are handled. And by extension, they've accepted the moral risk of a passenger, for example, in your car. They're going to give that passenger some additional coverage.
Counsel, do I understand that all of this argument, including the subset argument that you're making, has as its foundation, as the condition predicate, a definition of the word only? Is that what you're – all of this funnels down to how you define only.
And I think you're
right. In
Justice Bradley, I think you're getting what I'm trying to say, perhaps not as artfully as I should. The petitioners want that statute to read all. What would the case be if it was all just the opposite? The red circle would be 62846 claims. The blue circle would be 64631 sub 2 people. They would say, look, I see the third-party claimant. Of course, it's entitled to interest. That's what they want you to see.
Mr. Piper, wouldn't the all refer to classes that were not enumerated in 64631 sub 2? Wouldn't that be the larger class?
Well, is Your Honor asking if the statute used the word all?
No, what I'm asking you, when you define your set-subset type theory and referring to the all of 640-631 sub 2, as I read 628-46 sub 3, it's a statute that limits coverage to those who would be covered in 31 sub 2. There could conceivably be other people who might want to file claims that would be outside of 640-631 sub 2.
Sure. What the legislature did, and maybe I can explain it this way. Let's imagine the legislature did not want to reference the Wisconsin Security Fund statute. And instead, they just wanted to put in sub 3, who does the interest statute apply to? They could have done that. And what would they have likely done? They would have said, all right, who does Wisconsin have connections with? We want to get our residents protected, maybe certain non-residents under certain circumstances. They would go through the list and come up with all of these people, and they probably would have said third-party claimants who make a claim under, very important word, under an insurance policy. They might have done all of that, but they took a shortcut. They said, all right, we already have this list in the security fund. And it really accomplishes the same purpose. We have connections to the state, and we want to protect these people in both statutes. So they found a convenient list and adopted it by reference, not by incorporation.
What's the difference?
Well, I believe that when we talk about incorporating the statute, we're trying to make 646 interact completely on a wholesale basis with 628-46. And if you're referencing, we're just getting a list of people who can make claims.
Let's take out the word only for a minute, okay?
All right.
And it says this section applies to the classes of claims enumerated in 31-2. All right? So then we get a non-resident coming in and wants to be within 628-46, right? And interprets 3 to say, look, it's ambiguous. It clearly applies to the classes of claims enumerated in 31-2, but I'm not within that class, and it doesn't say that it is an exclusive provision of coverage.
Here's all
right. Take out the only, right? All right.
And so what they attempted to do, I suggest, by putting in only, is to clarify the ambiguity I just raised, so that you have to fit under both statutes. You have to fit under 31-2, and if you don't fit under 31-2, you can't come in to 46.
And I agree. When you said, if I may,
yeah,
when you said it has to fit under both statutes, that's what I was trying to say, perhaps inartfully, in the subset overlap. Yes, you do. And this is the statute that controls.
I think that your colleague from an American Standard would just draw them differently. Draw the red one as the larger one of claims to be paid under 2 and the smaller one under 46 and say, okay, you might fit under 31-2, but you can't fit under 46 because the whole concept of 46 doesn't work in this particular instance.
Just a couple of points, if I could. I do think that 646-31 sub 2, we want to talk about it as the classes of claims because the statute says that. But when you read the statute, what does it do? It identifies people. Right down the list, it identifies residents, certain non-residents, and so forth. It identifies people under this classes of claim category. And what controls is the wording of 628-46, which...
You're saying the same thing, it just doesn't cover third party.
Right. And this is the key. This is the absolute key. To get the overlap, you have to understand that not you, but I have to understand and people have to understand that 628-46 is truly a first-party claim statute. And if I could have 1 minute on that point, it really is important. The words of the statute, the background of the statute.
What statute are we talking about?
I'm sorry, 628-46. The words, the background, and the context. Just make it crystal clear that this is a first-party focused statute.
Counselor, I have to interrupt you. I'm sorry, just for a minute. I was looking at your terminology that under 646-31-2D, it was important for us to look at the word under, that there was a claim made under a liability policy, and I suppose that's as against a liability policy like a third party would make. But if I refer you to sub B in that same section, it talks about life insurance claims, claims made under a life insurance policy. That would be a first-party claim.
Right.
So I'm having a little trouble with assuming that under identifies first-party claimants in the way you suggest.
I'd be happy to respond. First-party claims are made under an insurance policy. A third-party claim is made against an insurer. The Court of Appeals, and for that matter, our brief cited 645.683M of the statutes, which makes that distinction very clear. And actually, the under versus against distinction is in harmony with both 628-46 and 646-31-2D. And let me give you some examples. We've talked about the 2D passenger who can make an uninsured motorist claim. But we also have the workers' comp example, where an employee who's a stranger to the contract issued to the employer makes a claim under the work comp policy. We also have, even in the security fund scenario, the word under is consistent. Here's how I understand things work at the security fund level. The tort victim makes a claim against the tortfeasor. And if the tortfeasor has an insurance company that went belly up, that tortfeasor tenders the claim to the fund. The tender is actually a first-party claim for indemnification, defense and indemnification obligations. And the fund then pays the third-party claimant because they received the tender. It fits, in the words, under a liability policy, except it actually is under a liability policy, parentheses, now substituted as the fund. end of parentheses. So this under versus against distinction, I think, is in the statutes. It's understood as a common distinction, and it all makes sense in both statutes. I'm sorry, I just noticed my red light's on.
That's fine. Counsel, would you just conclude your argument in just a couple of minutes, please?
I'd be happy to. Some, but not all, people can make 628-46 claims. 628-46 sub 3's use of the word only tells us this. 628-46 does not apply to petitioner's claims because 628-46 has a clear and exclusive first-party focus and is considered to be a provision of the insurance contract as a matter of law. It's the Anderson case. In this regard, petitioners are strangers to that insurance contract idea. To construe 628-46 otherwise would be to ignore an insurer's duty to defend obligations to its insured, and in that regard, no one who buys insurance wants their insurance company to prematurely settle, only to later on realize, my God, my insurance company bailed out on me and the facts weren't quite as bad as they were, and then have to be stuck paying your own attorney's fees.
What protects a third-party claimant against a liability insurance company just not paying and debating how much and whether there's liability? So you might have a policy of $5 million, right, coverage, and you have a rear-end collision and you have a paraplegic. Why can't the insurance company do discovery? And you know there's potential delay in getting a verdict and then not getting a verdict and settling on the eve of trial. And in the meantime, you have a paraplegic sitting there with no money. What? You can't use bad faith. Bad faith is out because it's not a first-party claim. What keeps the insurance company in line?
A number of things. The tort victim-plaintiff files suit, and if they're so sure of their position, they file requests for admissions. The statutes say that if those admissions are not accepted, not admitted, and there's no real basis for not admitting them, the plaintiff can get actual attorney's fees. They can also file an offer of judgment, and that'll give them 12% interest.
Only if they get judgment, I gather.
That's true. They can, if they want to, on a bigger picture approach, they can contact the insurance commissioner and complain about the handling.
Okay, but on even the request for admission, if they ultimately settle, that settlement is going to take care of that attorney fee issue. I mean, they're going to just settle for policy limits.
Well, I submit that when people settle, everything gets thrown into the...
That's right. So it's not much of a problem. Well, you have to spend all your attorney fees getting that judgment.
I'll just give you my experience. I've practiced law since 72. It seems to me that when plaintiffs get around to settling, the amount of money that is part of a settlement includes everything, to include this time value of money concern. They simply say, all right, this is the amount of money we want, and this is what happens.
Not when you're at policy limits.
All right, you're sliding into American standards.
I know, but I'm asking you that because it could have been your client, too.
When you have a policy limit situation, obviously that puts a different spin on things. I don't think it changes the rule and the response of Attorney Ratzel, however, which I agree with, which is if it's going to be a 628-46 claim, it's got to be a first-party claim.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Do you want the red and blue circles in the record? Just trying to be a good Chief Justice.
Thank you. In my brief time, I would just like to respond to a few points. All of the arguments we've heard today from the other side, I think, fall into four categories. First category is the statute doesn't mean what it plainly says. The second category is, well, the statute could not possibly mean what it plainly says. The third category is the statute should not mean what it plainly says. And the last category is, even if the statute says what it says, please don't enforce it. I want to start with the first category. This insurance security fund issue, the issue about under versus against, you know, parsing over prepositions, I just don't understand it, and to think that the legislature is that careful in the choice of terms that it carefully chooses one preposition over the other, I think is absurd. The one thing I would like to point the justices to is under the security fund statute, I'm looking at 646.13B. That sets forth the duties and powers of the board, the security fund board. B says, stand in the position of the insurer in the investigation, compromise, settlement, denial, and payment of claims under 646.31 and the defense of third-party claims against insureds. That's what the security fund statute says. Now, under the Court of Appeals decision and the argument advanced here by my colleagues, they would have you believe that even though the purpose, one of the purposes of the board is to have the security fund stand in the shoes of the insured to defend a third-party claim submitted against the insured, that the security fund doesn't apply to third-party liability or property damage claims anymore, but rather a narrower class of claims if you're really a first-party disguised as a third-party. Also, in that context, it's important to note that throughout the insurance code chapter, which would include 646.11, the definition, I'm looking at 600.03, subparagraph 26, or subsection 26, insured is defined throughout the insurance code as, quote, any person to whom or for whose benefit an insurer makes a promise in an insurance policy. And it goes on to say it includes, quote, policyholders, subscribers, members, and beneficiaries. So the narrow class of so-called third-party claimants that the Court of Appeals says still have claims under the security fund statute, they are not third-party claims as those claims are defined under the security code. Why? Because those are beneficiaries under the policy. The policy that I take out on my car says that if the driver hits me, who doesn't have insurance, and I have a passenger in my car who is injured, my insurance company also promises to pay not only my claim, the policyholder, but that person, that passenger. That passenger would beneficiary under my contract. And so the point is that clearly the security fund statute, when it uses the term third party, and even despite the 99 amendments, was not seeking to obliterate the largest category of third party claims that would need the security fund for payment, which are property damage and bodily injury claims. And the further proof of that is under 646.31.2. Not only does it list third-party claimants, but under subsection E, it lists assignees, and under subsection F, it lists beneficiaries. So, again, that's consistent with the definition of third-party as not simply being a beneficiary or an assignee. The argument that somehow the statute applies to some of the claims under 646.31.2, but not all of the claims under there, is frankly an argument that makes no sense. To accept that argument, one would have to believe that the legislature intentionally enacted an ambiguous statute. This statute here, 628.46, applies to some of the claims over in this other statute, but you know what? We're not going to tell you which ones. You have to guess which ones. That's absurd. Of course the legislature was intending to say this statute, 628.46, is not going to apply to all insurance claims, but rather only those insurance claims that are also subject to the Wisconsin Insurance Security Fund. That's why they use term only, to make it clear, I suggest, one of the possible reasons is to make it clear that it's not every insurance company, but only the ones that are also subject to the security fund. And I think they did that by deliberate design. And it's also important to note that this is consistent with the broad interpretation of 628.46 as applying to all insurance companies and all claims, because likewise, the security fund statute applies broadly to virtually every insurance claim that could be brought. So they go hand in hand. They aren't one big group over here of claims that are covered and a smaller group over here.
Counselor, when you first started out, you talked about a statute and you read from it about defending against or defending or investigating third-party claims. And I was trying to write it down and I missed
I'm
it.
I'm sorry.
Tell me what it was. The
I'm
first
going
statute.
So fast. I'm
That's
sorry.
Right.
It's 646.13,
uh-huh.
Subparagraph B.
131B.
Sorry.
Okay. That's where you lost me.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry
no
about
problem.
That. The other point I want to make, I see my time is up, I would just like to leave with this point. This court, there's a lot of hypotheticals that have been bandied up. There's a parade of horrible things that could befall everyone if third-party claimants can submit claims and they're subject to 62846. The court is not called upon in this case to address every issue. Just like with every other issue that comes in front of the court, there tends to be additional cases that come down the pike years later and the court goes back, revisits, refines. The important thing about both of these cases is that request to admit in the Bayet case was sent out on the negligence issues, and Metropolitan admitted that their insured was negligent in causing the accident and Mr. Bayet's injuries, and admitted that Mr. Bayet was free of any contributory negligence on his own part. So that case does not involve any liability issue. There's none there.
Okay.
And with respect to the Kontowicz case, sorry.
Red light is on, and if I let you proceed, I'm going to have to change the disk, et cetera. So I'm going to.
So I'm done. I'm cut off.
Quits.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. That ends our proceedings on 2003 AP 2177, Kontowicz versus American Standard Insurance Company and Bouillon versus Metropolitan Property and Casualty. I want to thank all the attorneys for their briefs and for their excellent argument on this difficult statutory interpretation case. We'll take a couple of minutes recess so the students may leave if they wish, and other students may come in.